Hey guys, Dr. Z, the legendary god of all vaccines, Paul Offit, welcome back to the show. My intro has gotten shorter and shorter for you over time. thanks for coming back. You've been all over the news. You're a vaccine researcher. Your credentials, you've been on the show a bunch of times. Here's the bottom line. We're all wondering, we're looking to you, Paul. And again, when we start asking scientists to be all over our shows, it means that we're probably in the apocalypse. And so as an apocalypse, does this have an end date? Are these vaccines looking exciting to you?
It's pretty amazing, really. I mean, you know, there was an article published in Science in January of 2020, which was the SARS-CoV-2 genetic sequence. That's when we had the virus in hand and we had the sequence. So we knew the sequence that then coded for the coronavirus spike protein. I think if you asked 100 scientists in January, do you think that by the end of the year, we will have done two large prospective placebo-controlled trials of 30,000 and 40,000 people using a technology we've never used before, which is to say messenger RNA, and have the kind of efficacy that you're seeing at least at top-line data. And it's all press releases. So I'm on the FDA's advisory committee, vaccine advisory committee, so we'll be looking at these data on December 10th and 17th. But, you know, that 90 to 95% effective, virtually 100% protective against severe disease, virtually 100% effective in people over 65 years of age. No one would have believed that. I mean, it's remarkable.
Paul, it's crazy because you're on the FDA advisory committee. So you're going to look at this raw data, at which point I'm going to come back to you and be like, okay, between you and me and about 2 million people that are watching, you know, would you take this vaccine? But even before that, remember the conversations we had early on in the pandemic where you and I were both like, well, so tell me, what's the feasibility of this thing happening within the next year? And the skepticism was through the roof.
Definitely. No, I've been like pretty much consistently wrong, which amazes me why you still have me back on your show. It's like when Christiane Amanpour, right at the beginning of March, we were having our first deaths from COVID. I mean, I got on her show and you know, CNN International, and said, I just can't imagine that we're going to have like the same number of deaths we had last year from flu, which was 60,000 deaths. I said, I can't imagine that. Because, you know, if you're going to be wrong in front of millions of viewers on international television. You know, that's the way to go. Don't just tell your friends something that's wrong.
Well, but this is why I love you, because we share something in common. We are often wrong, but yet are learning from the errors as new data comes out and coming out and still saying, instead of doubling down on the errors, right? And I think that's the difference between science, which is always trying to find truth and learning, and everything else. And so let's dig into this more now, because, okay, both of us are pleasantly amazed. I wouldn't even say surprised, amazed at the speed of this. And we have to give credit where it's due. It seems like Operation Warp Speed was effective as a public-private partnership to help take some of the risk out of developing the vaccines that would normally have then taken multiple years. And I want to ask you about that, but the follow-up to that is, what do you say to people who are like, well, this was too fast then, because if it normally takes 20 years and $1 billion and we did it in a year, how can it possibly be safe? And I'd love to hear how you think about that.
Right. So the trick is to do a phase 3 trial. I mean, as long as you do a phase 3 trial, you're then holding this vaccine to the same standard you want every other vaccine. So if that's true, if we've done a phase 3 trial in the Pfizer case of 44,000 or the Moderna case 30,000, Johnson & Johnson is going to be close to 60,000. I mean, that's the size of any vaccine trial. So if that's true, why are we doing this through emergency use authorization? Why aren't we doing this the way we always do it, which is submit a biologics license application, have a licensed product, and then go to the CDC for recommendation? And the reason is that the FDA, I think, would never license a product that was tested for this short a period of time. So then the question becomes, how risky is it? So there's two ways to look at this. First, safety, which is what most people care about. The good thing that happened here, and the thing that I was most worried about actually, was that Commissioner Hahn would not stand up to the administration. That really scared me, because you saw what happened with hydroxychloroquine, you saw what happened with convalescent plasma, where it looked like the FDA was just ceding to the whim of the administration and not standing up for the American public and making sure we got products that were safe and effective, because neither of those products had been shown to be effective, yet they were approved through emergency use. So then you come to vaccines. So vaccines are tested in these big trials. Safety-wise, when Commissioner Hahn said, we need to have 2 months of safety data after dose two, at least 2 months of safety data after dose two, then you knew that this vaccine was not going to be approved before Election Day. When he did that and he got enormous pushback from the administration, still stood up for that, that was great. Because If you look at the serious side effects of vaccines, and vaccines can have serious side effects, they all occur within 6 weeks of any dose. So safety-wise, I feel pretty good that you can say at least you don't have any relatively uncommon severe side effects. So then the issue becomes efficacy. You're going to be able to say that this vaccine was effective for a couple months. That's what you're going to be able to say. So how big of a risk is that? If you say something's 90 to 95% effective for a couple months, does that mean it's not going to be effective at 6 months or a year or 2 years? But the truth is, you're not going to do a two-year study with this vaccine before you release it. I mean, you know, more than 260,000 people died this year. It's a risk that you're taking. I think it's a small risk because I think if something is 90 to 95% effective in 2 months, it's likely to be highly effective 6 months later, a year later. We'll see. The key, by the way, and the questions I want to ask when I'm at the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee on the 10th is, do they have data on the frequency of memory B and T cells? Because that's what you really want to see. If you have a high frequency of memory, then you can feel pretty good that you're going to have fairly long lasting immunity, meaning a year, two, 3 years. The antibody titer itself per se doesn't bother me as much. It's the frequency of memory B and T cells. And we'll see whether the companies have those data.
Okay, a few things. This is great. So phase three trial with 30,000 people, right, or more, depending on the trial, and you have Pfizer, you have Moderna, these are the leading mRNA vaccine candidates. What you're saying is they compressed this sort of 10, 20-year period into a shorter period, but the business end of that period is always the phase three trial. That phase three trial is looking for safety and efficacy signal in a significant number of people with a true placebo control. And that appears to be what's happening. You're going to look at the primary data as part of the committee. That appears to be what's happening with these two leading candidates from Moderna and Pfizer. And that being said, the major safety signals that you're concerned about will show up usually within 6 weeks. We're going to have at least 2 months, probably longer, of trial data to show serious adverse and unusual adverse reactions. And that is enough for you, Paul. If you looked at that data, you know the efficacy data, you've seen it, and you've had maybe 2-3 months of safety data, would that be enough to convince you to get the vaccine or give it to your family?
Yes.
Yeah,
it would. If the data are as good as they look, I mean, just truth be told, we have already received our package from the FDA, so we're looking through it now.
Yeah.
The public will see what we're seeing on December 8th. So the public will see 2 days before the FDA Advisory Committee. But we're looking through now, sort of a massive amount of data, but we're looking through it. It's always transparent. I mean, you can see what we see.
So this is important because it's not like you're just going to get all this data on the 10th. You have the data and you're looking through it. It takes time and all your resources are aimed at this thing. So you're going to have something for the public by that time. And it's just amazing that it's all come together in that cohesive way. Now, again, we'll see what the final data shows, and I think that'll be interesting. So you're going to look at safety signal. Now, to get into that, and I think this is important, we should talk a little bit about these mRNA vaccines. I did a show recently describing how mRNA vaccines would work, but I really want to talk to you about this. So, because this is a new technology platform, although it's been in development in some way worked on since at least 2005, right? Can you kind of walk us through how the mRNA process works?
No, that's exactly right. It's been, me too. I mean, you'll always just see this described as a new technology, but it's been at least, 10 plus years in the work. People like Drew Weissman, actually, at the University of Pennsylvania, is one of the sort of leading researchers in this. He's been working on this for a couple of decades. The way it works is, so messenger RNA is just a small piece of genetic material, which we have in our bodies all the time. Our cells are making messenger RNA all the time because that messenger RNA is then translated to proteins, which then are excreted from the cell. So that's how we make proteins. So it's a very common molecule that is in your body all the time. Here, the piece of messenger RNA codes for the coronavirus spike protein. So that's the protein that emanates from the surface of the cell. That's the protein that's responsible for binding the virus to the cell. So the thinking is if you can make antibodies to that protein, then you can prevent the virus from binding the cells, which is basically the way we make the hepatitis B vaccine, the human papillomavirus vaccine, which is you make antibody responses to that surface protein. So Here, the trick, the hard part here is getting it into the cytoplasm of the cell. I mean, messenger RNA is a very labile molecule. We all have in our body something called ribonucleases, which if I just inoculated your muscle with messenger RNA, you would break down that messenger RNA in moments. It would never get inside a cell. So to get it inside the cell, they put it into this sort of this like complex lipid capsule. It's like a little tiny capsule, little nanoparticle. Into which then this messenger RNA sits. That's very, when the cells will then, when this lipid sort of layer that surrounds the messenger RNA hits the surface of the cells will then take it up. And then the lipid layer sort of dissolves. The messenger RNA now goes into the so-called ribosomal system where it's translated to a protein. And then that protein is either, it sits on the surface of the cell or it's excreted from the cell. That's how it works. And it's not just the muscle cells that'll do this. It's also, and frankly, even more importantly, the antigen presenting cells, like so-called macrophages, dendritic cells, which will then present this protein to the immune system. So you can get not only antibodies, but also get so-called T helper cells, cytotoxic T cells. So that's all important, I think, in preventing or preventing this disease.
Perfect. And so what's interesting about the mRNA approach is, part of the way they were able to make this platform work is they were able to stabilize the mRNA through a synthetic nucleoside process, right? Where normal viral mRNA appropriately not only generates an inflammatory response itself because it's a foreign thing, but is broken down by the enzymes that you mentioned, the ribonucleases, et cetera. So there's two things, right? They modify the nucleosides and they create this lipid nanoparticle protection. Are these artificial nucleosides something we should worry about? Because I can already hear the anti-vaccine voices in my head. You've synthetically created something and you're injecting it into me.
Well, so again, it's messenger RNA is itself an adjuvant, meaning stimulates the immune response, stimulates your innate immune system as distinct from your adaptive immune system, which is kind of a more specific part of your immune system. It stimulates the innate part of your immune system, specifically these so-called toll-like receptors 3, 7, and 8. So they've modified it so it really can't do that. That's good. So it doesn't really have adjuvant activity. So that's good. And the nucleoside analogs that they're using are the nucleosides that we normally have. It's not like they got them from Krypton and brought them in and then put them in. So it's that's true. The question I get asked the most though is, will it alter our own genetic material?
Yes.
I mean, that's what people are really worried about. So I can't emphasize enough how hard it is to get something into the nucleus.
Yeah.
So for example, if you look at DNA vaccines, which are again, like mRNA, instead of being a sort of so-called naked strand of messenger RNA, it's a naked strand of DNA. In order to get that DNA vaccine into the nucleus, you use something called an electroporation device, which is a gun. It's just like what it sounds. It's an electric shock that causes the nuclear cell membrane to become porous. It's hard to get DNA into the nucleus, and the mRNA never gets into the nucleus. Although it's always interesting to me that people say when they're worried that you're going to sort of alter their genetic material, and then they're going to get like autism or diabetes or multiple sclerosis. Nobody ever thinks maybe I'll have X-ray vision. It becomes spider. No one ever thinks that. Why can't it be a good thing?
You know what it is conspiracy theorists are always glasses half empty kind of guys, Paul. I mean, for me, I would think immediately, oh, I can see to Mars instantly or, become invisible. Okay, this is a very important point. I did a whole video kind of debunking what Christiane Northrup, this obstetrician, was saying about this incorporating into our DNA, the adjuvant, the metal adjuvants causing us to become 5G antennas, none of which are true. And so we've kind of gone through this territory and it's fun and enjoyable until people believe it. And then you're like, my gosh, help us. So back to the mRNA, the nucleosides they're using are the same sort of modified nucleosides that we would naturally make. So are they methylated or what's the dirt on that?
Yeah, no, I think they're just what you would normally find in nature. So I mean, since that seems to be the word that appeals to everyone, it's not, although there's a synthetic molecule, I mean, it's made in the lab. It's not using materials that you wouldn't normally find in nature.
Got it. So it's not like we're growing it in yeast and it's biologically produced. We're actually synthesizing these nucleosides because they're relatively simple compounds.
Right. And that's actually the beauty of this. The hardest part of this process is not this synthesizing the mRNA. That's not hard at all. It's mass producing that little lipid capsule. I mean, that's where Pfizer just got into trouble. I don't know if you saw that they said that they were lower on these sort of, certain materials, certain raw materials. That's what they're talking about. They're talking
about the lipid. It's the lipid nanoparticle.
as a friend of mine who was actually the head of manufacturing at Merck once said, when this all first started, he said, you know, this lipid particle has never been scaled up before. And that was really what people were initially worried about. But it's, you know, when you think about it, so what's the dose? The dose for Pfizer is 30 micrograms. A microgram is a millionth of a gram. That you can make kilogram doses. A kilogram is 1,000 grams. So there's a billion, you know, micrograms in a kilogram. There's a billion micrograms in a kilogram, which is to say you really can scale this up to inoculate the world. You can once they get rolling.
So it's a really good platform for that because number one, you don't have to rely on culture or biological organisms to spin it up. You can synthesize it. All you need is the code of the virus and you can start working on it. The mRNA codes specifically only for that spike protein. So you're not making spurious proteins and assuming that once it's transcribed and conforms, it actually looks like the real viral spike protein so you don't get a side effect like something you were talking about before, antibody-dependent enhancement. Can you tell us about that real quick in terms of a concern?
Yeah, so antibody-dependent enhancement is that when you're infected, so dengue is dengue virus is an example. You're infected with one serotype of dengue, and then when you're challenged with, say, a second different serotype, the antibodies that you generated from your first infection, instead of neutralizing the virus, instead of making it so that it can't enter cells, actually binds to the virus, doesn't neutralize it, and actually helps it get into the cell in sort of this Trojan horse manner. It actually facilitates viral entry into the cell. There's nothing about this virus that makes me think that's going to happen. Although it happened with SARS-CoV-1 in experimental animal models, there's no evidence it happens in experimental animal models. Here, if you look at animals infected with SARS-CoV-1 and then reinfected with SARS-CoV-1, do not have this antibody-dependent enhancement phenomena. The convalescent plasma didn't do that. None of the vaccine experimental animal vaccine trials have shown that. I don't think that's going to be a problem with this. As more information comes out, I don't think it's going to be a problem. I think in an earlier show, I had said, you know, we're worried about it. It's something certainly people are going to look for. But as the more information comes out, I don't think it's going to be an issue.
That's very important because you would have seen a signal of antibody-dependent enhancement in this huge phase 3 trial because you would have seen people getting sicker potentially in the vaccine group than not in theory. But there's other, like you said, there's the animal studies, there's convalescent plasma, which has all this mix of antibodies, and still you don't see antibody-dependent enhancement of this Trojan horse sucking this virus in by binding to non-business end parts of the virus. Now, I have a question about this. Since this is a messenger RNA molecule and a synthetic lipoprotein, lipid nanoparticle, is there a chance that immune system is going to mount a response to those particles in a way that generates an autoimmune crossover?
Well, not the lipid. I mean, you'll make an immune response to the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, and the SARS-CV2 spike protein, to some extent, will be expressed on the surface of the cell. So it is possible that those myocytes, the muscle cells that have that on the surface, will then be destroyed by, say, cytotoxic T cells. That's possible. And when you see, you know, I should say one other thing, actually. Remember that in these trials, I think for both Pfizer and Moderna, those researchers have not excluded people who've been naturally infected. So in other words, if you've been infected and you have antibodies at the start of the trial, you still are part of this trial. So we'll have those data, too.
Perfect.
We'll have people who were or not infected who were then vaccinated.
And we'll know who those people are theoretically based on their testing results. So that's excellent because that's another question was, if you've already been infected, should you get this vaccine? And the data will bear out whether it's safe and effective to do that. And we'll talk about why you might want to do that anyways, might not. But so back to the, so yes, of course, the muscle cells that took up this mRNA that are now expressing the spike protein on their surface or inside or nearby could be the target of an immune response. And that may explain some local redness and that kind of thing that people get. But a question that I had is, there are these exuberant reports, and again, I haven't seen the primary data, it's all press release stuff, but of, you know, muscle aches, headache, fever, that seem pretty strong sort of effects. Is that an example of the adjuvant effects of the virus, the lipid nanoparticle, or is it just a natural response to spike protein antibodies being made and the immune response to that? Or are we missing something?
I think it's probably both, but but I do think that the immune system needs a better public relations team working for it, because all this means is I hate the term sort of adverse event. It's not an adverse event. I mean, when your immune system is stimulated because of natural infection or because of vaccination, you make a series of proteins, so-called cytokines, that are associated with these symptoms, low-grade fever, and then the symptoms associated with low-grade fever, headache, chills, muscle aches, et cetera, joint pain. That's okay. I mean, that means your immune system is working. I have a friend actually from who's in North Carolina who volunteered for the Pfizer trial. And so, right, he doesn't know whether he's going to get vaccine or placebo. So after he gets the second dose, he wakes up the next morning, he's got, you know, headache, he's really pretty fatigued, and, you know, significantly fatigued. And he turns over to his wife and he goes, "I got the vaccine. Yes." See, that's the right attitude.
It's a superpower. Well, so, and that relates to another question about this. Two questions, but the first is important. I want to make sure we talk about this. The fever response, not just to vaccine, but to infection. Isn't that a favorable response in general to create a scenario where immune system works better, the molecular machinery of the body works better at those higher temperatures? I mean, that may be the evolutionary reason for fever. Is there danger to actually treating that fever with Tylenol, ibuprofen, NSAIDs, et cetera, when you're trying to maximize immune function and response?
Absolutely. It sort of breaks my heart a little bit when you read the details of these trials, that they offer, you know, fever reducing medicines like Tylenol or acetaminophen or ibuprofen for people who have symptoms. There's clear data in children, two huge studies showing that when you get a vaccine and you start to develop fever, you anticipate there's going to be fever and treat with anti-fever medicines, that you lessen the immune response. Because as you say, I mean, why do we all make fever? Why are we all willing to spend this metabolic cost for having fever? And the answer is because our immune system works better at a higher temperature. White cells kill bacteria more efficiently. B cells and T cells, or B cells make antibodies more efficiently. T helper cells help B cells make antibodies more efficiently. Fever is our friend. You know what I'm saying? And if you look actually at the details of this trial, I think this has been published. Can I say this? I think this has been published. But the people who are over 65 actually have less reactogenicity to these vaccines than do people less than 65, because their immune system is more sensitive. That's why.
That's absolutely fascinating. I need to tell this right to camera. Fever, if you can tolerate it, is a good thing for your immune system and your response, especially. And it's interesting, you said it broke your heart to see that they're prophylactically treating for fever or whatever. But what's interesting is at least they did that, which is what the public's going to do. And so we still get data based on what real world application would be. And it's still quite efficacious. it's really interesting because, again, we've been taught, you know, cool people down, treat their fever, et cetera. But this is part of the response. Relating to that, so men seem to get so much sicker from everything. I mean, I am a victim of man flu every time I get sick. I don't get sick very often, but when I do, I'm unconscious, whereas my wife just brushes it off, my two daughters brush it off. Is there a component of how men's cytokine response is different, that they feel all these sort of flu-like-y symptoms and muscle aches and fevers more?
You know, it's true almost across the board for infectious diseases that men do worse than women. It's we're the weaker sex. I mean, as I think it was Murphy Brown who called it that silly little Y chromosome. You know, I think she got it right. So I'm not sure why. Although it's interesting, in this there was a couple of papers in Science for SARS-CoV-2 showing that when you're infected with this virus, men more so than women will make antibodies against their own interferon. You know, so interferon is a protein made by our immune system to interfere with viruses' ability to infect cells, which is why at least these two papers were postulating that men might do worse here. This is one weird virus, by the way. I mean, that it has the capacity to make you induce antibodies against interferon is remarkable to me.
This is amazing, because it means that if the wild-type virus can induce antibodies, at least in men, to interferon, that could actually make you sicker because you don't have the same immune response. That would imply then that the vaccine, which is more focused on the spike protein, is more effective immunity than actually wild-type exposure to the virus, in theory.
That's right. You know, people have postulated that. I mean, it may very well be true that vaccination is better than natural infection, which is why, by the way, getting to your earlier question, for people who've already been infected and go, hey, you know, I don't need the vaccine, I think, first of all, programmatically, I can tell you in our hospital, we are not going to be screening people to see whether they were infected or not.
Right.
We're just with everybody who's frontline responded to the vaccine. And so programmatically, it doesn't work. But secondly, I think you could make an argument just biologically that you may be better off getting a vaccine than having been naturally infected.
So again, and it gets to that question of, okay, so there's not really, we're going to see if there's any downside to getting vaccine after you've been infected based on the data, because again, there will be people there in that trial that had that. And there is a theoretical advantage to being vaccinated, which then goes into that next sort of logical question, which is, duration or reinfection ability with this virus. Now, I think before we talked about this idea that like something like RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, that really sickens a lot of people around the world. And, you know, they had a lot of trouble making a vaccine partially because of antibody-dependent enhancement. I think that was a vaccine, and you can correct me when I'm done ranting. and the second problem is that RSV's incubation period is very short, which means this will get into how does memory immunity work when you get reinfected, because people get so confused. Can you walk me through this and help me understand, say, the difference between a short incubation like RSV and something medium like SARS-CoV-2, where it's more like 6 days mean incubation time?
Right. So take measles. Measles has an incubation period of more like 10 to 14 days. Mm. That's because viremia, meaning spread of virus into the bloodstream and then to distant sites after it initially enters your nose and throat, it takes longer actually to develop measles. So that's good for your immune system because it gives now you've been immunized against measles. You know that when you're exposed to measles, it's going to take a fairly long time for that virus to do what it needs to do to then cause disease. So that's plenty of time for activation and differentiation of memory cells to become, say, antibody-producing cells, which protects you. That's why that kind of virus, you can actually get sterilizing immunity to that, because it's a long incubation period. And when there were outbreaks between 89 and 91 in the United States, where there was, you know, like 50,000 hospitalizations and a number of deaths, there were a number of children who didn't have circulating antibodies at the time, but were completely protected because they had immunological memory. That's all you need is immunological memory. If you take the short incubation period diseases, where it's like 1 or 2 days, 3 days, I mean, something like rotavirus, the virus that we worked on, or flu can have an incubation period as short as 18 hours. There, you know, it's not a lot of time for the activation and differentiation of memory B and T cells to protect. So it usually takes about 3 to 5 days for that to happen. So there, in those kind of diseases, what you see is you see incomplete protection, meaning you get usually protected against moderate to severe disease, but not so much mild disease. This virus is in between those two. This virus, just as you said, it's about an incubation period of 6 days. That's a lot of time, actually. And I think that as long as you have immunological memory, I think you're fine. I hope the companies did those studies. Because there was just, I don't know if you were listening to TWIV, This Week in Virology. They had a virologist named, an immunologist named Shane Cronley on recently, who studies coronaviruses. And that was his point. And I think he's absolutely right.
That's absolutely fascinating, because you know so many people are stressed out, well, is the immunity going to last? And the truth is, again, this may be another compelling reason for vaccination, even if people who've had COVID before, because then you get a more specific, it's almost a booster. And if you're going to get reinfected, if it's somewhere in between, maybe at least you don't get severe disease, right? And maybe that's a way masks work a little bit too, just by reducing inoculum, so you have less out the bat that you have to react to, less of an inoculum out the bat. And it really makes you think that this sort of, it's almost a hysteria that, well, this thing's not going to last. You're going to get reinfected. There's no hope. What's the point? Let it rip through the population is just not correct. I mean, is that how you feel about it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the notion of, first of all, there's never been no virus has ever eliminated itself from immunity induced by natural infection. None, zero, never happened. So when Scott Atlas gets up in front of the American public and says, let's just let it burn, I don't know what he's talking about. The only thing that we've ever eliminated viruses is with a vaccine. I mean, we eliminated smallpox by a vaccine. We eliminated 2 or 3 serotypes of polio with a vaccine. Only vaccines can do that. You know, one other thing, by the way, people get hung up on, you know, the antibody titers, just getting back to what you were just saying. You know, look, antibodies seem to fade, antibodies were high or low. I really do think we're focusing on the wrong thing. I think the question is, what is the frequency of these memory cells? That's going to be the key. One other point, by the way, is in terms of reading through some of these data, I think what the companies are going to need to answer, for me anyways, is one question, is If you look at the placebo recipients, depending on the Pfizer or Moderna trial, it looks like about the infection rate, or not to say infection rate, the disease rate in the placebo group was, depending on which study, was like either 0.7% or 0.85%. That's surprisingly low. Yeah. You know, you would have expected it to be more like 3.5%, just given where these studies were being done. So why was it low? And I think the what you worry about a little bit is so-called volunteer bias, meaning that who volunteers for these kinds of trials? Certainly a lot of healthcare people volunteer for this trial. So this may be people who are more attentive to their health, more likely to wear a mask, more likely to social distance, and therefore more likely to be exposed to a smaller inoculum. Mm. That what we're looking at in these trials is protection against a smaller inoculum. And then when it gets out there into the real world, when you're being asked to protect against larger inocula, and there's clearly a relationship between the amount of virus that you're exposed to and the severity of your disease, that it may act differently. So I think that's one question that's going to need to be answered in these meetings.
Oh, man, that's so important. I want to say that again in a slightly different way. So what you're saying is, because these trials were kind of the optimal population of people who care about their health and maybe their healthcare workers, it's going to show maybe a higher efficacy and a lower infection rate in general, which is what we did see, a lower infection rate than what you might predict. And so that is yet more compelling reason to answer a question that I've been thinking about myself, which is, why would you wear a mask and social distance after you've been vaccinated? And the answer is quite clear that no vaccine is perfect. And even if the trial says 95% efficacy, that's a trial. The real world is going to be different. And I think that's very important. And again, correct me if there's anything I just said that's wrong there. Was there anything that you disagree with?
No, you're absolutely. And the one other thing to add is that we don't know whether this vaccine protects against infection. I mean, we know that, meaning, which is to say, asymptomatic infection, where you can still shed virus and be contagious. We know that it protects against disease. We know that. We don't know whether it protects against infection.
That's what I wanted to ask. So we could still have infection. I think this happens with influenza vaccine as well. You can be infected, potentially asymptomatic, don't know about shedding, but even though you don't get sick, and maybe the vaccine helps you not get sick, but you can still infect others. So this idea of, at least in the short run, continuing to be precaution, it's not panic, it's not hysteria, it's just pragmatic science from your standpoint, yeah?
Yeah, so you could argue, if you want to be completely selfish, you'd be, look, I got the vaccine, I know I have a 90-95% chance of being protected against disease associated with infection, but I still may get infection and still shed the virus, but who cares? As long as I'm protected against disease, I'm good. This just means that other people who come in contact with me will get infected, and the hell with them, let them get vaccinated. But, you know, first of all, not everybody can be vaccinated. No vaccine is 100% effective. You do live in this society where you actually should care about your neighbors, so that you really should still wear a mask and distance. But I think it's going to be hard. It's hard enough to get people to do that now without a vaccine.
Yeah, exactly. And now, so I want to get back to, speaking of like libertarian ideology, let's get back to the herd immunity thing and like the atlases and so on. One question I had relating to that, you may not eliminate virus with natural herd immunity, but natural infection, because now we're talking about maybe a quarter of Americans, we don't know the exact number, may have already been exposed and infected at some point, whether asymptomatic or not. Will that help lower the overall threshold of vaccination requirement to reach a stable herd immunity in the community?
Yes, it's a high price to pay for that, but there are definitely people who are much, much less likely to get disease associated with exposure. I mean, I think you're right. I think the numbers are like 12 or 13 million. That is off by at least a factor of five, and maybe a factor as high as eight. So that is true. And paid a price for that.
It is a price. Now, so that gets to my follow-up question to that, which is, let's say we have an infection fatality rate across the board for this thing in the U.S., and I'm making this number up a little bit based on, you know, hearing different things. Let's say 0.3 to 0.5. So, and again, I don't know what the exact IFR is. I don't think anyone really knows. But infection fatality rate, meaning of all the people out there infected and we haven't necessarily tested them, but they've been infected, what's the fatality rate? At 0.3, people will push back and say, why should I take a vaccine that may have a 1 in a million side effect when I'm reasonably healthy, the IFR is quite low. Why should I do that? I mean, how do you think about that?
Well, this virus doesn't just kill you. I mean, flu is more like that, right? Flu, you live or you die. But I mean, this virus causes vasculitis. It causes inflammation of your blood vessels because every organ in your body has a blood supply. Therefore, every organ can be affected. I mean, you know, I have to give a talk tomorrow, actually, with a guy who's with the Army. And there's this Army sort of fitness thing that but you know, he's taking care of a number of young, healthy adult males who have heart disease associated with having been infected with SARS-CoV-2. So the virus can cause strokes, heart attacks, kidney disease, liver disease, these long-termers, you know, the so-called long haulers, they in part may be associated with what is a vasculitic phenomenon. When we had a child who came into our hospital who had pneumonia, a teenager, you looked at that chest x-ray, it looked like lupus. I mean, it looked like a vasculitis. It didn't look like a typical so-called interstitial pneumonia that we normally see. This is a scary virus. I mean, you don't have to die as your only outcome. This can cause longer-term problems. I mean, and think about it. When it causes changes in taste and smell, it's because the virus enters the brain. That's why it does that.
You know, what's crazy, Paul, is when we had our first conversation way back in the spring, we were like, you know, this thing feels a little more flu-ish, like we're panicking, we're shutting down schools, we're turning everything inside out, ripping the fabric of society apart for basically, you know, an IFR that's not going to be that high and so on. And as we've learned more, it's clear that, and something you said is very important here, this is this may be an autoimmune phenomenon of being exposed to wild type virus. In other words, that virus is more complex than just the spike protein. Something's happening because it's only 1% of people, I think, are actually viremic, actually have blood viral replication and, you know, virus in the blood. So how is a virus that lives in the oropharynx, the epithelium in the lung, upper respiratory and lower respiratory system, how is that causing systemic vasculitis? And the answer is it's got to be an immune reaction possibly, right? Is that how you think about it?
Now, people, there was a false notion actually early on that the virus could infect endothelial cells, the cells that line blood vessels.
Right.
That's not true. I mean, it's not viremic, less than 1% of the time. So you're right. It induces your immune response to affect endothelial cells. That's one of its many horrors. And this has only been out there for a year. We're still learning about the unusual clinical and pathological changes associated with this virus. This is a scary virus. I mean, that's why I'm most scared of it. Not that I think I'm likely to die. It's that I think I'm likely to have this vasculitis, which can cause a variety of difficult symptoms.
You know, I have to say, because I've been very sympathetic to the arguments that our response to the virus is potentially more harmful than the virus itself, I think I might be willing to change that or modify that approach, seeing data on actual numbers and impact of this post-viral syndrome that we're seeing. And it is true, so young people are having strokes, but then the question is, what are the numbers, and is it significantly different than, say, Coxsackie virus or something that we know can cause cardiomyopathy? You know, is this something novel in a sense that it's doing these things to a degree that we don't see typical viruses doing? What's your intuition on that?
Yeah, I don't understand this virus. I'll be perfectly honest with you. It's this bat coronavirus that clearly does things in us that we haven't seen before. I think we haven't really worked out the mechanisms by which that happens. I mean, what is the mechanism for this multi-system inflammatory disease of children? I don't know. And people are worried about the vaccine because they think, won't that trigger this? And,
yeah.
And you know, my answer is, I don't know, because you don't really know what the basis of that is. I mean, when we talk about it being like Kawasaki's disease or toxic shock syndrome, but the kind of profile that you see is the cytokines and chemokines are not really the same as those. It's just a different virus.
Mm. You know, this is interesting because now it gets to the question of, we don't know that the vaccine is going to cause these effects. We will get good safety data for at least 2 to 3 months from these trials. So we'll have a sense, but of course you can never know, right? But that gets to the question of mandating the vaccine, say for healthcare workers. Now, these are people that have patient contact, et cetera. We often will mandate a flu vaccination, at least for purposes of employment. That dog is so cute. Oh, my God.
She's had a Screen Actors Guild card for a year and a half, so don't worry about it. She's good. Right, Rose? Good? Actually, we've been working on this, so let me just go through this. Is it Timmy Rose? Is Timmy falling in the well? Okay, I'm done. It's a laughing joke. Ask your parents about it.
I forget what I asked, Paul. What did I ask you? the dog's so cute. Look at it. It was a question about, mandating vaccines.
Right, right.
So do you think we need, are we going to, is it ethical to mandate? I mean, what do you think about this?
Well, practically, there's not enough vaccine out initially, so you can't mandate something that is incredibly short supply. Two is, I honestly don't think you can mandate this until you feel very comfortable that you don't have a rare side effect. I mean, this is a novel technology. It's combating a virus that is continuing to surprise us. I think we have to be humble here and realize there may be things we're going to learn over the next year that we don't know now that we wish we knew now. I don't think you can mandate. We're not mandating it in our hospital for those two reasons.
Right. And that makes perfect sense. And I'm a bit of a libertarian at heart, and I don't think mandate. I think there's enough people that are going to want to take it. And there are people who, with this information that we're talking about, will do a risk-benefit analysis on themselves. Look, Paul, I'm 47, but I have factor V Leiden and prothrombin 20210A heterozygous mutations that I found out on a 23andMe, you know, genetic survey. So I have a reasonable genetic risk of clotting. We know this virus can cause clots. I'm also a healthcare professional. So I would elect, with a one in a million risk of serious adverse events, say, let's just make that up, I would elect to take the vaccine because my chances of an adverse event from natural wild type infection are, in my mind, a little bit more scary and higher. And I'm going to do that risk analysis, right? But there are going to be some people who just don't want to get it. And whether they end up getting wild type and generating immunity that way, I think eventually we'll get to the goal without having to force people to take a vaccine or any of that. Do you agree?
Agreed. And people, the question I commonly get is, and I just think it's off, is, you know, do you think because so many people are scared of this vaccine that we'll never be able to inoculate enough people to you know, to induce herd immunity that stops spread? I don't think that's going to be the issue at all. I mean, I think if this vaccine holds up in terms of the percentage efficacy that we're seeing, I mean, if it holds up in terms of safety regarding, you know, rare, remember, the first group that's going to get this is roughly the 24 million people that comprise, you know, healthcare workers and residents and staff of long-term care facilities. You're going to have 20 million doses, 20 million people inoculated before we ever get even close to the general population, because then you have to go to essential workers, then you have to go to greater 65 and healthcare people who have various health problems. You're going to have tens of millions of doses out there before you ever get to the general population. So I think that should be very reassuring to people. To me, it's the Beanie Baby phenomenon. I mean, it's the value of the limited edition vaccine. I mean, that happened in 2004 with the flu vaccine. There were companies that had trouble making it. So there was a limited amount of flu vaccine. That was a highly sought after vaccine. I think at some level, that's going to be this.
I remember that. Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. And that gets to a couple of questions. Why two, let's say Pfizer, Moderna, two shots weeks apart? Why? Why do we need to do that?
That's what induces the best immune responses. I mean, the Johnson & Johnson is a single dose vaccine because that was good enough. I think AstraZeneca thought they could get away with a dose, but then they realized they needed a second dose. And so now they have some problems with regard to whether it's half dose or full dose. We're not going to be seeing that vaccine for a while in this country. I could be wrong.
Yeah, we'll do another show about that vaccine because I was just looking at that going, wait, what? Because we're just not there yet. But the Moderna and Pfizer, so the two doses, best immune response. So what happens if you get one and you flake on the second?
Well, first of all, it's the question is, was there any immunity induced after just one dose? There is an answer to that. That answer is actually in the materials that I've seen. We will soon know that. The country will soon know that.
I love it.
Two is, you know, if it goes through pharmaceutical companies, I mean, I'm sorry, if it goes through pharmacies, retail pharmacies, they're very good at letting you know that they want you back. I mean, if my iPhone is any example of that, with regard to your prescription is ready, they'll let you know.
That's true. And, you know, I don't think we'll get into the storage of these new vaccines and how they have to be at minus 70 for the Pfizer and minus, what is it, 4 or something for the Moderna. Okay. Yeah. So distribution is going to be tricky. Where do you think, you know, we talked about, you know, I know there was actually an interesting contrarian opinion I heard from somebody on the CDC committee who was saying, you know, we shouldn't be giving it to people in nursing homes and older people because what we're going to see is a temporal correlation. Those people are more likely to die or get something serious anyways, and the public is going to conflate, just like in flu vaccine. I took the flu vaccine and then I got flu. Well, no, you didn't. And this is what's going on. He was worried the same thing would happen with elders. I mean, how do you think about that in terms of distribution?
I listened to that meeting. I think the person who said that, it was a heartfelt, serious concern that she had. I just think that that her concern was that that hadn't been really, she worried about the safety in this older age group. I mean, first of all, the most impact you have in a nursing home is actually to vaccinate the staff. I mean, even more so than the nursing home residents themselves. But, you know, 40% of the deaths occur in nursing homes. You've got to immunize people in nursing homes. We will have a lot of data on the greater than 65-year-old and the greater than 70-year-old. So, I mean, there are those data. And I just think that, you know, you never know everything before you launch a product. The question is, when do you know enough to say that the benefits outweigh what are at present the theoretical risks? And I think we're there. I mean, we'll see how this meeting goes on the 10th and on the 17th, but it certainly looks good. We actually had a practice session today for that meeting. I mean, we're so nervous about that meeting because, you know, it's open to the public and we want to know, how can we communicate with each other? How can we communicate with the chairman of the meeting, and how's this all going to work? Because I think it'll be, you know, be picked up. It'll be shown on, you know, the news and stuff. They just want us to, you know, make sure that we don't, you know, screw up.
I'm so glad you're in that meeting, Paul. I mean, this is like what you've been called to do for your whole career. Is like, here we go. Now you get to give this gift of wisdom and experience and humility to the public. I have no doubt you'll crush it and do the right thing and interpret that data. And, you know, one thing I wanted to just because a lot of people are concerned about these things, human cell lines from, you know, legally aborted fetuses in the 60s or whatever, they're not used in the mRNA vaccine production.
Not in the mRNA vaccine. Right. No, the AstraZeneca vaccine uses this so-called HEK293 cell at one point, which is this human embryonic kidney cell. So yes, and Johnson & Johnson, their replication defective AD26 did use the so-called PER-C6 cells, which was, I think, from retinal cells. These are elective abortions that were performed. One, I think, was in 75. The other one was in 82. So this is it's an old cell line, but
right.
they're used in research, these cell lines.
That's right. They're immortalized cell lines. And the Pope himself weighed in on this, I believe, and said, you know, the goods of vaccinations outdoes the moral injury of the original abortion in Catholic dogma. So, and I did a separate video on this, but yeah, so that, take that off the table. And the other thing is, people are saying the vaccine makers have no liability, so they don't care about safety. What do you have to say to that?
Well, I actually don't. You should actually bring a lawyer like Dorit Reese into your program. She's amazing, and she really understands the law about this much better than I do. It's not to the advantage to a pharmaceutical company to make a product that is dangerous. I mean, it doesn't help them. These are multinational companies, as a general rule. If they put a product out there that is unsafe, they will suffer that. So, but I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure whether there is federal. Whether this is going to be like the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, where there's sort of a federal umbrella here, which is basically the way it worked with the swine flu program in 1976. That was that then. I don't know how this was working now. I don't.
Right. So it'll be different. But yeah, I imagine it'll be made safer for the vaccine companies just because of the tremendous liability risk if there is some, you know, undetected serious side effect that's going to happen, adverse event later. Children.
Yeah, one thing, interesting. I think if you look at the roster of people that are on the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, it's really an amazing group of people. So Arnold Manto and Haley Gans and others are just these brilliant, caring, you know, researchers and stuff. It's just, you should be glad all those people on this committee. It's an amazing group who really wants to get it right. It's ennobling to see the people like that that are in this country.
You know, that's important to say. The other thing else, and you, by the way, you're all vaccine, you're all pharma shills as far as I'm concerned. Okay, Paul, I mean, every last one of you. But the other thing is, this is one of those few pharmaceutical products that every single person technically might be getting, right? So everybody's skin's a little bit in the game. Like, you know, it's not some evil pharma lord in his office going, well, even if we kill everybody, it will be rich. It's like, well, no, Smithers, you're going to be getting this vaccine probably too. And
petting the cats,
petting the cat, right. Like, excellent. Well, we'll fire the vaccine. Relating to that, children. So, and I know you got to run in a second and teach a thing. Children, I know Pfizer expanded its study to include all the way down now to 12 years old, but how do we think about kids? Because kids can still, I mean, I think it killed about as many people as influenza killed so far in terms of children.
You know, I think we need a vaccine for children just for that reason. If we have a flu vaccine, it's the same, roughly the same number of children, 120, 130, 140. As SARS-CoV-2 and flu, and it causes, you know, this multi-system inflammatory disease of children. It infects children. If you can prevent that disease safely and effectively in them, then do it. the Moderna also just announced that they were going to do this 3,000 person placebo controlled trial in children, also going down to 12 years of age. And we'll do what we normally do, sort of work our way down in age to see this.
Got it.
So I think that'll help.
Yeah. And then the last thing, so you, when are you going to know whether you and me are going to team up and get this vaccine live on TV?
You know, I'm happy to, the way this will play out is December 10th, the FDA will make its determination. Within a day or two, the ACIP will. And then by December 15th, Pfizer's vaccine is probably going to be shipped and used. Then a week later, December 17th is when Moderna's will be looked at by the FDA. Within a day or two, ACIP will look at it, and then December 22nd. So I think December 15th and December 22nd are the dates those two go out. I think we're going to be vaccinating people in our hospital by the end of December. So I have direct patient care. So I'm not in that first line group, you know, sort of ED and people who work in ED. But I should be right there in that sort of right beginning of the second line group. So yeah, I'm happy to get. I'm happy to get somebody getting a little iPhone and tape me getting that vaccine.
I love it. I love it. Well, I'll have to fly out and give you COVID and do it together, you know? Man, Paul, okay. I know you got to run. This has been so helpful. Our audience is going to get so much out of this. This is a gift that you give so freely of yourself, educating and entertaining in the process with that dog. I mean, it's really not you, Paul. It's the dog that was just stole the show. Thank you. And man, we're all rooting for you on this panel and everybody, all the great people on the panel to look at that data, science the crap out of it, and let us know what you think, because I'm going to wait to see what you think, look at the data, and then make a recommendation to my own audience. So thank you. And I'll see you. Hopefully you'll be back.
Love to. Thanks, Zita. Look forward to it.
Thanks, brother.
Take care.
All right, guys, please share the show. And that's it. Just share the show. We are out. Peace.